This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get an in-depth update on the health condition of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Public pressure has really drawn attention to the serious medical conditions faced by Mumia.
We'll talk about the destruction of the Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus.
The camp once held over 150,000 people. It now holds 18,000. What happened and why?
We hear a presentation by Joan Gibbs, activist, attorney, and writer, and was among four panelists speaking at the event, U.S.-Cuba Relations, What Does Normalization Mean? In her presentation, she addresses the question of whether Cuba will give up the many political prisoners, including Assata Shakur, to whom they have given asylum. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week there was an article about a group called the Illuminators, and it sounded like some Vatican cult to me. But who are the Illuminators? What happened?
Well, they came in in their action after the initial action in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn, where this great group of people put up a huge bust of Edward Snowden in Fort Greene Park in a martyr's site.
A martyr's site from the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
People who died on a British prison ship.
Yeah. And so it was a fitting site for a martyr like Snowden, who after his revelations about the nature of the police state, that they're spying on everybody here, he's now been charged with espionage, and he's taken refuge in Russia. So they put this bust of Snowden up in the Fort Greene Park, and the city took it down within a day. And then the Illuminators come in. Tell what the Illuminators did, Michael.
Well, the Illuminators are amazing. They came out of Occupy. They're the people who put up slogans on the walls during Occupy, the 99%, the 1%. I remember seeing them crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. And what they did is they made a hologram of Snowden, and then they were going to focus it on top of the statue, on top of the column where they had put up the original bust, where the other people put up the bust. And how did they get it to be a hologram? They threw ash up in the air, so you had a cloud of ash, and within that ash, they focused with their hologram camera the bust of Edward Snowden. And so you had a hologram of Snowden on top of this column. So we have to say this is great art and great politics.
Journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal continues to be in serious medical condition at SCI Mahanoy in Frackville, Pennsylvania. He has lost over 50 pounds and his body is covered with a hard, painful layer of jet black skin that is both bloody and itchy. Last week, his blood sugar registered in the mid-200s and continues to fluctuate, with doctors injecting a double shot of insulin right before he was brought out in a wheelchair to see visitors. As of that visit, he had not been seen by a diabetes specialist, and there is concern that the insulin injections may result in an overdose or cause organ damage. Support and demands for medical attention and an improved diet continue to pour in from around the globe. Joining us with an update on Mumia's condition and efforts to raise awareness of his condition is Johanna Fernandez, assistant professor of history at Baruch College and an active member of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
Johanna Fernandez, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Johanna, you've been to visit Mumia Abu-Jamal since he was hospitalized and then returned to SCI Mahanoy. Your first visit to the prison was on April 3rd. What happened there?
Well, I think it's important to give your listening audience a sense of what happened. That Monday, March 30th, Mumia collapsed in the infirmary room and he was rushed to a nearby hospital. He registered blood sugar level of 779. And just to give you a sense of perspective, diabetic shock registers at 800. His sodium level was especially high at 168, which is potentially fatal. it could lead to brain aneurysm and heart attack. 3 days later, on Wednesday, he was returned to the prison infirmary. And the next day, on Thursday, he collapsed and was in the bathroom for 45 minutes before a doctor and a prisoner found him on the floor. On Friday, April 3rd, we visited with Mumia after a series of phone calls and negotiations with the prison. They finally allowed his attorneys and a small number of supporters to visit with him. And Mumia was in very bad shape. He was wheeled in a wheelchair. He was very weak. He was coherent, but it was very difficult for him to sustain a conversation for the hour that we were there. We visited again on Monday, and he was better. And that was the day that we took the photographs. He was better than he was on Friday. He was a lot more alert, but clearly, as the photographs show, he had lost 50 pounds in less than 3 months, and his skin is terribly raw and hardened and black everywhere in his body except his face. So we are wondering what exactly has been going on medically for the last 3 months, because he had been under the care of prison doctors for 3 months before the collapse. And part of what we are saying as a movement is that this is an attempt at execution through medical neglect. We don't understand how he could have fallen into such a crisis over the course of 3 months without serious medical intervention.
Yeah, I understand that he had 3 blood tests prior to his collapse, and you would think that those blood tests would have indicated a rising level of sugar and salt.
Absolutely. He had 3 blood tests in February. And as we all know, diabetes is easily diagnosed, and he was showing all of the symptoms of a serious diabetic condition. He was lethargic, falling asleep, weight loss of this kind, 50 pounds. All of these are signs of untreated diabetes. So these are the questions we're asking. It appears that there was serious medical neglect in his case.
Now, Johanna, I understand that during that period of time, he actually had difficulty staying awake during the day, overslept one morning, and then was written up with a disciplinary action for missing the morning call and breakfast.
And that was the first sign that there was something terribly wrong going on. Mumia reported to us in early January that he had to be shaken out of his sleep during count by prison guards. And for not being awake during count, he was disciplined for 2 weeks, not allowed phone calls, not allowed visits, and not allowed to go out to yard. As we all know, Mumia is very disciplined. He writes around the clock. He's a prisoner who follows all the rules. And this was very uncharacteristic of him. And this was the first sign that there was something going on with his health that was serious and needed immediate medical attention. And 3 months later, he collapsed in the infirmary room. He walked himself to the infirmary room that morning on March 30th. And he told us that he was walking sideways and blacked out just as he entered the infirmary room, and he didn't wake up until hours later in the hospital.
It's also disturbing that you've reported when you visited him that he had been injected by prison officials with a couple of insulin shots. I understand that can also be precarious.
So
almost to make him look more alert, perhaps?
Well, it's unclear how he's being treated for diabetes at the prison. He has not yet seen a diabetes specialist or an endocrinologist, despite the fact that his blood sugar continues to fluctuate wildly. This is what he reported to us. But he did tell us that right before the visit, he was injected with two shots of insulin. I think we don't know why that was the case. Doctors do say that insulin should be administered regularly at the same time every day, and we fear that's not happening. Mumia also expressed to us that there are approximately 100 prisoners who line up every morning to get insulin at the prison. So this is a rampant problem behind the wall. There are approximately 80,000 prisoners with diabetes, and the medical contractor at SCI Mahanoy, Corizon, has been sued numerous times by prisoners and their families for malpractice, and they've actually won. Corizon is an HMO that routinely engages in cost-cutting practices. They register a profit of $1.5 billion.
When you say they won, the individuals, the prisoners suing Corizon, have prevailed in their claims for lacking services, which is good. These services are woefully inadequate, aimed at profit only.
Absolutely. And what we see in those photos that were circulated of Mumia is that for the past 3 months, he's been tortured medically. His skin, it's important to draw attention to what's going on in his skin. And as you know, the skin is the largest organ in the body, and it probably reflects deeper problems in his constitution. He likened his skin to that of an elephant. For 3 months, his skin was raw. He was not able to sleep because it was burning and itchy, and he was regularly bleeding. So this condition went uncontrolled for 3 months, and in fact, he got medication which produced a violent reaction. He said that his skin blew up to three times its size, and finally it ruptured his skin. His skin opened up. And at that point, he was placed in the infirmary, in the prison infirmary, for 2 weeks. So these are the circumstances in the run-up to his final collapse in the infirmary room on March 30th. I think it's also very important for your listening audience to know that a prisoner in March protested Mumia's condition. A prisoner by the name of Major Tillery walked up to one of the administrators and said to the administrator, "What are you doing about Mumia? He needs immediate and serious medical attention." Major Tillery's cell was stripped that day, and he was transferred out of the facility. So there was retaliation against this prisoner for speaking up on behalf of his peer. And Mumia told us the story on that Monday we visited, and he said that action literally brought him to tears. A prisoner would put his own safety on the line in solidarity with him. And Mumia also expressed the importance of addressing the broader crisis of healthcare behind the prison wall. he would want us to really call attention to what appears to be a human rights crisis of epic proportion, and really a crime against humanity, to allow prisoners to suffer indefinitely under his conditions for months and months on end. This is one of the dirty little secrets of the crisis of mass incarceration that rarely gets attention.
Johanna Fernandez, tell us what you and the other leaders in the Mumia Defense are doing and what we and our listeners can do.
Our immediate demand is that Mumia be allowed to be seen by an independent team of medical specialists. He needs to see an endocrinologist, a nutritionist, and a dermatologist. And he has not been seen by any specialist up to this moment. We're asking people to call the Department of Corrections and demand that he get the proper specialized care he desperately needs right
now. People should get their pen and pencils, because you're going to give us the numbers to call. But tell us more about what you've been doing to get the prison people to do the right thing.
You should call the Secretary of Pennsylvania Corrections, John E. Wetzel, and that number is 717-728-4109. Once again, that's 717-728-4109. And the demand is that Mumia be allowed to see a team of specialists chosen by his family and supporters to assess and evaluate his condition. We have been to the Department of Corrections to request a meeting with the Secretary of the Pennsylvania Corrections, John Wetzel. There have been thousands of calls to the prison and the Department of Corrections. We also held a vigil outside of the ICU in the waiting area where Mumia was hospitalized. And we truly believed that the mobilization of people across the world, in Philadelphia, in New York, in Washington, D.C., and our presence saved Mumia's life. But Mumia is still in danger. His life is in danger, and we need to continue to call.
Johanna, speaking of the attention that these actions have gained, I understand that some teachers delivered letters that their students had written to Mumia. Was he able to see those letters?
A third grade teacher in Orange, New Jersey, delivered a series of letters that her students wrote for Mumia. And we were able to deliver those letters on Monday to Mumia. And this was the first time we'd seen Mumia smile chuckle.
Johanna, could you read us a short excerpt from one of the letters that the students wrote?
One of the letters reads as follows. Dear Mumia Abu-Jamal, I care about you getting out of prison. I care for you, and I am a third grade student. What I am trying to tell you is that grown people don't only care about you. I will do whatever it takes to get you out of jail. I will call the hospital as many times as it will take. Love, Samir.
Well, we have a young activist in the making there.
Yeah, we sure do. John Wetzel, call him at 717-728-4109. That's John Wetzel, 717-728-4109.
Johanna, thank you so much for everything you do on behalf of our friend Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you, Johanna.
Thank you for giving voice to the voice of the voiceless when he needs it most.
Thank you, Johanna.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've reached the office of Secretary John Wetzel, Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. I'm either on another line or away from my desk at the moment. Please leave a message at the beep. Thank you.
This is Attorney Michael Smith in New York City, and I'm here with Attorney Michael Ratner and Attorney Heidi Boghossian. We have a radio show that's broadcast nationally called Law and Disorder, and we're doing special broadcasts on Mumia Abu-Jamal's health. The reason I'm calling is to ask you what the status is and what you plan to do in terms of getting him specialists to treat him. The fear that we have and our listeners have is that the man is in terrible condition, that he's totally under your control, and that he may not make it. So I'd like you to please call me back at my office, and I expect to hear from you. Thank you very much, Mr. Wetzel.
In a situation the United Nations has described as beyond inhumane, last week an estimated 300 ISIS extremists converged on Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus after 3 days of fighting. Humanitarian aid has failed to reach starving residents there, even as ISIS members, many of whom appear to be Syrian, portray the attack as a liberation of the camp's residents. In fact, the residents, 3,500 of whom are children, had been under siege and starvation tactics for 2 years. Syrian forces control all entrances to the north and east of Yarmouk and have largely resisted pleas by UNRWA for parcels of food and water to be allowed in. Approximately 16,000 residents remain in the settlement, a decrease from 200,000 prior to the war. Most inhabitants fled to Lebanon, where they now live in overcrowded refugee camps. Many are refugees for the second time, having fled what is now Israel in 1967 or 1948. Some have attempted to flee on migrant boats to Europe and Egypt. Joining us today is Salim Salama, the head of the Palestinian League for Human Rights Syria and a former Yarmouk resident who fled in October 2012.
Salim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Salim, now, I know you're currently living in Sweden. You formerly were part of the Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria. But before we discuss the current crisis in Yarmouk, let's go back and talk a bit about Palestinian refugees, about which our listeners are probably not that familiar. Let's first talk about the gross number of refugees there are as we speak, and then focus in on Syria a bit. So in terms of gross numbers of refugees from Palestine outside of the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel, what is there?
In fact, following the Palestinian Nakba in 1948, around 90,000 Palestinians were displaced from Palestine. Those Palestinians basically from the north of Palestine headed towards Syria and Jordan and Lebanon. 90,000 of them ended in Syria, in fact. And following the creation of Israel in 1948, those refugees settled down forever in Syria because simply they couldn't go back to their country.
So you had 90,000 that went into Syria, and there were many others that went to other places. Do you have a rough idea of the number?
Not really, actually, towards Lebanon and Jordan. We need to double-check that, but I'm much familiar with the Syria thing. So
okay.
90,000 ended up in Syria. Shall we take over that again?
Yes, let's go back. So how many ended up in Syria?
90,000 Palestinian refugees ended up in Syria following 1948. And this number kept on growing to reach around 500,000 Palestinian refugees, or around 400,000 Palestinian refugees all over Syria. And among, of that number, of that total number, the 400,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria, roughly speaking, there were around 150 to 180,000 Palestinian refugees living in Damascus in Al-Yarmouk camp, which is considered as one of the biggest concentration of Palestinian diaspora outside Palestine. Those people enjoyed fairly similar rights to their Syrian countrymen and women. They had access to education, to health care, to public employment, and they lived within the boundaries of urban Damascus in a very vibrant economical, cultural, and political part of the city.
Let me go to your own refugee status. Were you actually born in the Al Yarmouk camp?
Yeah, actually, I was born in Yarmouk. I was born to a Syrian mother, so I'm half Syrian, half Palestinian. Father was born in Palestine in 1946, and then came to Syria as a refugee, and I was born as a Palestinian refugee to a Syrian mother in Syria.
And just to jump ahead a little bit, how come you're no longer in that camp?
In fact, in October 2012, I didn't feel safe anymore within Syria due to my human rights activities and also political opinions. And this is when I decided to leave the country towards Lebanon. Upon my arrival to Lebanon, a couple of weeks following my arrival to Lebanon, I discovered that actually I'm supposed to go before the terrorism court for the accusation of underestimating the prestige of the state, the president, and the army, which is there to protect people. And as a law student, I understood exactly the risks that I will be facing. My decision to leave Syria was pretty much a rational one. Those accusations, in fact, came as a result of my activity as a blogger, trying to sort of following the human rights conditions and the situation in the country. I've seen people, I've seen classmates being grabbed from constitutional law classes, being taken to detention centers, and I've never heard from them ever since. This is when I've decided that Yarmouk is no longer the refugee camp. It's no longer the house and Syria at all.
So there were 180,000 or more refugees, or children of refugees, but really refugee population of Palestinians in Al Yarmouk. And we're talking to you now because of the current crisis. And I think it opens really with, in some way, with the ISIS raid on the camp on April 1st. But by that time, there was already a huge reduction in the number of Palestinians in the camp. Am I right?
Definitely, definitely. In fact, it's a little bit tragic that we are only talking today because, or not we are only talking today, but we are talking because of what's going on in the recent developments. Because this recent development in the camp is one chapter of many chapters in the misery of the Palestinian refugees in Syria, which is part of the collective misery of Syrians as well. Yarmouk is under full siege and blockade since at least 2 years. On the December 2012, out of the blue, the Syrian regime jet fighters bombed Yarmouk, bombed a hospital, a school sheltering refugees, and a mosque, causing the deaths of tens of refugees from outside Yarmouk taking refuge in Yarmouk, taking shelter in Yarmouk. This triggered the sentiments of anti-regime opposition, armed opposition, which seized control over the camp. And in the following months, early 2013, the Syrian regime put siege on place, controlling the movement of people and goods on both directions. And by July 2013, this siege became a tight blockade where nothing goes in or out. No food, no medical supplies, nothing. And very few cases of people were allowed out for medical reasons in case the regime approved it. By 2014, we have documented 200 deaths because of starvation accelerated by dehydration due to the blockade imposed by the Syrian regime and the militias that are standing to besiege the camp with it. Those numbers are according to our own numbers and the numbers of our colleagues in Amnesty International. And what we are witnessing today in Yarmouk is just one new catastrophe within the catastrophe.
We're speaking with Salim Salama about Palestinian refugees, and we'll be right back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Thank you.
you're just joining us, we're speaking with Salim Salameh about the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Let me go back for a second, because by the time ISIS invaded the camp on April 1st, I'm reading a statistic from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. It says by that time there were only 18,000 Palestinians left in Yarmouk, just as of a few weeks ago.
That's very true.
Where did the other people all go? There's 140,000 missing, or 130. They had to go somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. In fact, following the bombardment of the regime on December 2012, tens of thousands have chosen to get out from the camp, and including them, my families. My father and my mother were there on their way back to Yarmouk on the 16th of December 2012, when they heard a jet fighter above their head bombing a mosque that is 100 meters away from our house. So they basically did a U-turn and just left back to downtown Damascus. But we are among very lucky group of Palestinian refugees who had the resources to reallocate to downtown Damascus. And then when the siege started to be imposed and taking a tighter shape, starting from the early months of 2013, people who could move, people who had the resources to reallocate, started to move outside Yarmouk, until we reached the moment of the total blockade on July 2013, when only the vulnerable of the vulnerable remained in the camp, the people who are living under all poverty lines and under all human dignity lines, and who has no other choice but to remain within the camp, remained over there. And this is the 18,000 that we are talking about today.
So that's the 18,000. And what happened then now on April 1st that the world, or at least some of the world, seems to be paying attention now rather than, of course, as the 2 or 3 years of evacuation and the bombing of the camp? What happened on April 1st?
Excuse my language, but I think it's always sexier to have some extremists over there in the streets of refugee camps in the outskirts of Damascus. Unfortunately, on the morning of the 1st of April, the Islamic State fighters decided that they want to expand their control over Yarmouk area. They have already existed in the southern parts of Yarmouk, in the neighboring block called Al-Hajar al-Aswad. They have just decided on the 1st of April to conduct large-scale military operations in the depth of the camp.
Salim, I understand that many of the ISIS members are portraying their attack as, in fact, a liberation of the camp's residents.
In their understanding, of course, this is a strategical gain to get into the camp, definitely. However, this is not the opinion of many residents within the camp, whose the only liberation for them is access to food. Some kids who were born under siege, they do not know what a banana means. So I think there is a contradicting perception of liberation, for sure.
There are a lot of children in the camp, aren't there? Over 3,500, I think?
Yeah, according to some international organization, there's some 3,500 kids within the camp. That's very true.
Has the United Nations relief people been able to do anything for them?
Not really. In the last couple of months, there has only a couple of days of food distribution within the camp. And we need to remember that there is one problem, that food distribution is not happening in a regular basis. There is another problem that, in fact, needs are beyond what is being distributed. Since 2 years, people are living in the very minimum. Some reports say that people within Yarmouk camp and also the greater southern sector of Damascus have cut down their consumption to 1 or 1.5 meals per day. So the situation is catastrophic. And with the entry of the Islamic State, people are trapped inside their houses since 1 week due to the ground clashes, but also due to the severe and intensive arbitrary bombardment from the Syrian regime side by indiscriminate weapons.
So what is the international community that's aware of this? What are their demands? What are people trying to do?
I think so far we have heard a lot of condemnation, which is not exactly what we are hoping for. As a human rights group in the Palestinian League for Human Rights, we've been in consultation with our colleagues inside the camp and activists and other testimonies we managed to get. We're asking for a safe passage to be created from the entry of the camp, which is under the control of the Syrian regime, to basically allow food, medical supplies, and the humanitarian and medical personnel inside the camp right ahead, and also to allow the people of the camp who wish to be evacuated to do so, or who wish to just leave by themselves to do so. This passage which we're asking for should be in two directions, for people and goods to move whenever they want at any time that works for them.
I mean, the situation just from the distance where we are, and I read your piece on your website or about safe passage, seems quite difficult. I mean, you have ISIS, and then according to the piece that I think was that was written by the Palestine League for Human Rights Syria, which is an NGO that that you founded, ISIS is there. Then al-Nusra is cooperating with ISIS and blocking anything into the camp. And then you have Syria bombing the camp. And so you have the Palestinians who are just in that camp without any ability to do anything. They're just caught, it seems, in this complete horror. I mean, is that an accurate description?
It is a very accurate description, in fact. However, I think our demand come in the light of what we've witnessed in the last 4 years and what we've gained and what we've learned in the last 4 years. That, in fact, there is always a way when there is a political will. We do believe that there is a lot of channels of negotiations between all the different parties, and we do believe that they can reach a consensus. But this consensus cannot be reached without the intervention of major powers to bring all the parties to the negotiation tables. And it happened in other places, although the Islamic State was not part of those negotiations in different cases. However, we do believe that there can be a solution. Yarmouk is surrounded by different areas that already agreed for a truce and a ceasefire. And we do believe that having windows of humanitarian aid from here or there, it's extremely possible. It just needs the political will and the humanitarian coordination between the different UN agencies.
Who are the parties that have to be brought to the table?
I do believe that this is something decision makers can analyze or speak of better than I can do. I do admit that it is extremely complicated and it is extremely delicate situation. However, I think that those answers exist somewhere within the Syrian leadership and the international community leadership.
And do you you still communicate with people in the camp, is that right?
Yeah, most of the activists and most of our colleagues at the Palestinian Leagues have already evacuated towards neighboring sectors of the camp. Very few people remain within the camp, actually, now.
What's the latest thing you hear from within the camp? How bad is it?
The last thing I heard from hospital. Medical supplies are needed now and very urgently, in addition to food. Yarmouk has no water since September 2014, in addition to all this, which means 8 months without access to drinkable water. People had to walk for wells that are manufactured by, that are made, built up by local community organizations, and now they cannot have that luxury anymore to go and get their water due to the ground clashes and aerial bombardment. So the call I received today from, and this is a quotation from what got to our colleagues inside the camp, it seems that we have survived 2 years long siege. It seems that we have survived snipers, aerial bombardment, and a lot of other forms of horror, but it seems that we are going to die thirsty. So I do believe that water, food, and medical supplies should be arranged into the camp now.
And in addition to those deplorable situations, are there communicable diseases or public health issues related to waste and sewer and stuff like that?
Definitely, it does exist, and it is an issue. However, one cannot ignore the amazing coordination between the civil society organizations within the camp, who, regardless of all odds, managed to maintain their minimum capacity and their minimum services provided. And they are doing excellent job in that regard, but it is the very minimum. So I think once we manage to get into the camp, what we don't know about is more than what we know about. Just we don't know because there is bigger issues now to be concerned of.
We're speaking with Salim Salama, who's the head of the Palestinian League for Human Rights in Syria, and a former Yarmouk resident who fled in October of 2012. Salim, do you have a blog or is there a website if people want to try to help out or stay in touch with this situation? What might they do?
I do have my personal blog on salimsalama.com, and you can find us on the Palestinian League for Human Rights on with the Oximity page. It's a citizen journalist blog called Oximity, Palestinian League for Human Rights.
Thank you for this, and I'm glad you're safe and not in that camp. Of course, these were refugees from 48, and you were one of the descendants of those. And you have a camp with 180,000 people in it. And only now, as you pointed out, are people concerned with the last remnant that's left in that camp. But where where was the world while both ANAPCA went on in 48 and now when 180,000 people or 160 were driven out of the camp?
Exactly. I'm very thankful to be a guest in your program today. Thank you so much for voicing concerns of people very far away from where you are. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Michael, we have the statistics on the number of Palestinian refugees by country as of January 2010. In the Gaza Strip, the number is 1,106,000. The West Bank is 778,000. Lebanon, 425,000. Syria, 472,000. And Jordan is nearly 2 million. In December 2014, Presidents Barack Obama and Raul Castro announced that the United States and Cuba would restore diplomatic ties and free the Cuban Five. We hear a presentation by Joan Gibbs, activist, attorney, and writer, who has represented and supported many political prisoners, including Herman Ferguson, Sundiata Akoli, and the Cuban Five. She's a member of the New York City chapter of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and was among four panelists speaking at the event, U.S.-Cuba Relations, What Does Normalization Mean? In her presentation, she addresses the question of whether Cuba will give up the many political prisoners, including Assata Shakur, to whom they have given asylum. Let's have a listen.
Our third speaker is Joan P. Gibbs. Joan is a longtime activist, attorney, and writer. She's represented or done support work for a number of political prisoners, including Herman Ferguson and the Cuban Five. She's a member of the New York City chapter of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and she also works with the July 26th Coalition. Joan will share her views on what impact the shift in policy could have on political prisoners from the U.S. that Cuba has given asylum to. In addition, Joan will discuss the history of African diaspora support of Cuba.
Thank you. Thanks to Gil for inviting me and for organizing this program. I'm going to try to be brief so that we'll have enough time to have the conversation. Since the triumph of the Cuban Revolution and January 1959, political activists in the United States who were fearful of escaping persecution have sought refuge in Cuba. For example, Robert Williams was one of the first to go. Robert Williams, in case you don't know who he was, was charged in 1960 or 61 with kidnap and other charges related to his activities in organizing against white supremacy and racism in Monroe, North Carolina. Robert Williams and his wife, Mabel Williams, lived and continued their work in Cuba from 1961 to 1965. While there, with the assistance of the Cuban government, the Williams established Radio Free Dixie, from which they regularly broadcast addresses to black people living in the South, published a newspaper, The Crusader, and also it was in Cuba where Robert Williams wrote his infamous Negro with Guns. In the years since, numerous African Americans, as well as other political activists from the United States, have sought refuge and been granted refuge in Cuba. Among them, Elvis Cleaver, Kathleen Cleaver, Huey Newton, Gilberto Morales, Nihanda Abedun, and perhaps most famously, Assata Shakur. In the aftermath of the 17th announcement by Cuban President Raul Castro and President Obama that the two countries would be seeking to reestablish relations, the release of the remaining incarcerated members of the Cuban Five, Cuba's release of Alan Gross and another U.S. Cuban spy, social media was afire with expressions of concern, questions about the fate of political prisoners in Cuba, in particular that of Assata Shakur. Some worried or expressed concern that Assata might be returned to the United States. Assata has a bounty on her head of $2 million. In 2013, Assata was placed on the most wanted terrorist list. And the bounty, which at the time was $1 million, was increased to $2 million when New Jersey added an additional $1 million. I know most of you know who Assata Shakur is, right? So I don't have to tell you about Assata. But if you don't know too much about her, I would urge you to read her autobiography and the autobiography of her aunt, Evelyn Williams, Inadmissible Evidence. I really recommend that you read Evelyn's book. I'm going to focus mostly on Assata because this is her case that is most well-known and has been the most attention of activists. Although I will say that what I'm going to talk about her applies to other political prisoners that have been granted asylum in Cuba as well. New Jersey has repeatedly asked for Cuba to return Assata. And some, including recently indicted New Jersey Senator Melendez, have insisted that normalization of relationship with Cuba be conditioned on the return of Assata and other political prisoners in Cuba. The Cubans have said emphatically that issues of Assata's return is off the table. A lot of people think, okay, well, they said that. But really, you know, the right of states, sovereign nations, to grant asylum is well established in international law, as well as in regional instruments. Every sovereign state is deemed to have an exclusive control of its territory and over the persons therein. Article 14.1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, provides, in pertinent part, a right for individuals facing persecution to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. Article 1 of the Declaration on Territorial Asylum, which was adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1967, provides that asylum granted by a state in the exercise of its sovereignty to persons entitled to invoke it under Article 14 of the Universal Declaration of Civil Rights shall be respected by all other states. Further, Article 1.3 of the Declaration vests the state of asylum, the state in which people are seeking asylum, with the authority to, quote, evaluate the grounds for the grant of asylum. The right of individuals to seek asylum is also enshrined in several international and regional instruments, including the Universal Declaration, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. International law, likewise, counsels against a state returning a refugee to a place of persecution. Support for that can be found in the convention related to the international status of refugees. That said, I am not, and in fact have never really been worried about Cuba returning Assata. Cuba has been the staunchest supporter of African and African people, including Afro people in the diaspora, since the revolution. When Africa called, Cuba answered in Angola, elsewhere, and most recently in the fight against Ebola. Cuba has been said by, among others, the late President Nelson Mandela substantially contributed to the end of colonialism and apartheid in Southern Africa. In return, African people throughout the world, including in the United States, have been staunch supporters of Cuba. During President Fidel's last two visits to the United States, to New York, to the UN, I, along with other African-American activists, including one who was in the room, Myrna, hi Myrna, welcome him and organize speaking engagements for him at the Abyssinian Baptist Church and at Riverside Church. They were attended by hundreds of people. However, all of that said, historically and still, the United States has not been noted for its respect for either state sovereignty or international law. Anybody disagree with that? The most glaring example of that to me at the moment, and people may disagree with me, is Venezuela and what they're doing to Venezuela. And in fact, I think this is an attempt to overthrow the Venezuelan government. But I am worried, and I must admit, for Asada and others, in particular Asada, because of the bounty on her head. The bounty hunters will attempt to kidnap her. But, however, I trust in the security apparatus of, our Cuban friends, because they have successfully protected Fidel for over 200 assassination attempts. I wouldn't advise going to Cuba to kidnap them. With that, I want to conclude by suggesting several things that we in the United States should do or should be doing. One, we have to support and defend the Cuban Revolution and the end of the blockade or embargo. To that end, I urge you to support IFCO and the July 26th Coalition of New York and New Jersey. Second, we have to demand that the United States respects Cuban sovereignty, international law, Cuba's grant of asylum to Asada and others who have fled prosecution in the United States. The United States has to respect that, and that we should make them do that. At the same time, we should demand the United States remove Asada, who is now 67 years old, from the FBI's most wanted terrorist list, and that the $2 million bounty on her head be dropped. And finally, because I think that this is something that I wasn't asked to talk about, but I will, we need to take up and pick up the work to free the remaining political prisoners in the United States, including Oscar Lopez Rivera, Leonard Peltier, Sanyana Coley, who was Sada's co-defender, and Momia Abu-Jamal, and the Move 9, who have been in prison for over 30 years for the murder of a single Philadelphia police officers. Thank you for your time.
I just want to say, with respect to Venezuela, I guess earlier this week, a couple of days ago, the president did the sanctions and said that Venezuela was a threat to the national security of the United States. Now, that's obviously false. Venezuela is not a threat to the national security of the United States. And, you know, so I'm worried about Venezuela, I'll honestly admit to you, because the U.S. media has played such a prominent role in portraying and misportraying what's going on in Venezuela. You know, when those demonstrations started, you know, we in the United States, I don't know why we do this, but we get up in arms when we see what we young people in the streets, right? These were young, petty bourgeois Venezuelans demonstrating against the government, right? It reminded me of what happened in Chile, because I'm old enough to remember how people came with pots and pans, women, to overthrow Allende. That's what they were doing. And people fell for it. I mean, I had arguments with people about, oh, listen, people are starving in Chile. Nope. This was the CIA trying to overthrow Chile. And that's what they're doing in Venezuela. And what we need to do is be about having forums, demonstration, and educating people and exposing that. Because we can't rely on the New York Times. Because the New York Times has been the ringleader in this campaign against Venezuela. You know, and then we have Join in Miami, I understand. I'm not a fan of Miami. But I'm told that there's all these Venezuelans who have fled from Venezuela to Miami, you know, and they just, you know, organize against Venezuela too and other places. And so I am worried about Venezuela because I think people really don't understand and they're not taking the time to see what's going on. But I will say this, Venezuela still remains one of the top suppliers of oil to the United States. Yeah. So with that, So with that, you know, but we really should be more active around Venezuela, because otherwise they will succeed, because they have definitely succeeded in convincing students, that a lot of young people and old, that Venezuela is, there's no democracy in Venezuela, you know, all of that.
This is Heather Bogosian from Law and Disorder Radio.
This is Michael Ratner, and we're here to talk about
the 7th Annual Folk Festival.
And this is Michael Smith, and I'm going to tell you about it. Old-time string bands, blues, jug bands, traditional Near Eastern music, Italian string music, West African music, songwriters, gospel, trad jazz, folk, and klezmer. It's all coming to you on April 17th through 19th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. Go to brooklynfolkfest.com.
Isn't there a banjo toss?
Well, there's the famous banjo toss. There's 30 bands, workshops, film screenings, jams, square dance, family events, and the banjo toss. Ask me what that is.
What is that?
Well, you throw a banjo into the East River. It's got a rope attached. The person that throws it the farthest wins the banjo, not the one that's wet.
That's amazing, because I thought you threw it through the windows of the banks that are too big to fail.
Brooklyn Folk Fest, 7th Annual, April 17th through 19th. Go to brooklynfolkfest.com.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.